camping. All right, take your Bible and open it to Ruth. It's a small book in the Old Testament. Might take you a minute to find it, but I'll get there. There we go. That's what I'm looking for. I'm going to talk to you about a concept first. It's a very common concept in the Bible. We're going to talk about, for the next couple of weeks, we're going to talk about Ruth. Ruth and Boaz in particular. Today we're going to talk about the character of Ruth. Next week, Boaz and why that matters and all that sort of stuff. Let me ask you a question. Who's your hero? Yeah, now, in this day and age, you know, there are a lot of different heroes out there. And whether it's, you know, athletes or celebrities or superheroes or whatever, I personally think that that's just a ploy to get us to buy their merchandise, and obviously it works for me. But if you ask people who've had a chance to mature, I mean, kids have heroes that are, you know, like maybe Superman and so on. But if you ask people who've had a chance to mature, people who are, you know, a little bit older, who their real heroes are, it usually gets down to one of two groups of people or some combination thereof, and that is teachers and parents. Yeah, those are the people who really have... Could you go ahead and shut that door back there, please? Those are the people that really have the influence. But, you know, that kind of begs the question, what exactly, when we use the word hero, what do we mean by a hero? In the literary sense, the hero is the main character of a story. The hero could be a triumphant hero or a tragic hero. That is, it could be a hero that we admire and look up to and should emulate or imitate. Or it could be someone whom we pity, feel sorry for, and whose mistakes we want to learn from and try to avoid. Now, as I've been reflecting on the Bible, I was thinking about this. Who are the heroes in the Bible? There are a lot of heroes in the Bible. But I remember as a kid, growing up in Sunday school and things like that, hearing about, you know, this hero or that hero, and in particular, all those who are listed in Hebrews chapter 11 who are identified as heroes of faith. And I had in the back of my mind, I mean, what a hero was. I knew what a hero was. It was, Superman and Batman and the Incredible Hulk and all that kind of stuff. You know, I knew what a hero was. And as I read the Bible, I thought, yeah, they're sort of like them, I suppose. But then as I matured and as I grew up, I read the rest of the story. You know, like we talked about last week, Samson. Samson wasn't much of a hero in many ways, was he? I mean, he had some issues. He was kind of a skirt chaser, and that was the least of his problems, although it did end up being sort of his fatal flaw. You don't want to say to your kids, hey, you need to be like Samson. Like, no, you need to be like Samson in one day of your life, okay? Because that's where Samson was a hero. And it struck me, in the Bible, there are essentially two broad categories or two types of heroes. The first is the hero who does something heroic. Might sound sort of obvious. But what I mean by that is people like Samson who aren't, to put it politely, particularly pious individuals. You know, they're certainly not known for being spiritual or godly people, but once or twice in their life, they did exactly what God wanted them to do, and they got it right that once or twice in life. So sometimes a hero is someone simply who has done something heroic in spite of themselves, in spite of their character. But there's another type of hero, and this is more rare, both in the world and in the Bible, and that's a person who is a hero who demonstrates heroic character. And that is the people that you can point to and say, yeah, you need to be more like that person. Now, I mention that because the truth is most of the heroes in the Bible are more the former. They get it right once in a while and get it wrong more often than not. But today we're going to take a look at Ruth, and she's one of the latter. She's one of those who, she's a life worth imitating. And so we'll see that. Now, in order to fully appreciate the story of Ruth, the story of Ruth and Boaz has sometimes been called a love story or the greatest love story in the Bible, and in many ways, I suppose that there's some truth to that. A very popular wedding passage, I'm going to read it here in a little bit. It comes out of the book of Ruth. It's kind of odd because it's really daughter-in-law speaking to her mother-in-law, but we typically understand it in light of, you know, husband-wife commitments and things like that. So it's kind of not exactly applicable to weddings, but it'll work. We can go with that. In order to really appreciate Ruth and Boaz's story, you've got to understand the context of the Old Testament and kind of what's going on. The Old Testament answers all of the biggest questions in the world. The first one being, where did everything and everybody come from? And so we learn from the Bible that everything and everybody came from God. Everybody's created in the image of God in some respect. But then we look around us in the world today, and we see the world's pretty messed up. I don't get much argument on that. You know, people say, you need to be more optimistic. I've had other people tell me, you're too optimistic. You know, you can't win with some people. Some people are too pessimistic. But, but the world is messed up. And so we understand where everything came from. So what happened? What went wrong? Well, the Old Testament addresses that too. What went wrong? The Bible talks about what went wrong. I'll give you a hint. It's not God's fault. Okay. And then the next big question that's addressed in the Bible in general and set up in the Old Testament is simply this. Is there any hope? You know, I used to make the mistake of having heroes who were politicians. What I mean by that is I thought, you know, if we'll just win this election, if we can just get the right people in office, then that'll solve all our problems. You know, it took me a few election losses and victories to learn that it just ain't so. That's just not the way it works. And so it's tempting and very easy if you look at the world around you and what should be going well doesn't seem to be, and what seems to be going bad, it seems to be getting worse all the time, you could real easily become very discouraged and just think, man, is there any hope in this world at all? I mean, look at the world, look at the news, look at my life, look at my, you know, whatever. You know, is there any hope? Well, the Bible addresses that and says, yes, as a matter of fact, there is. And the problem is, these problems that seem insurmountable, the reason why they seem insurmountable is because they are, and because we need something bigger and greater than ourselves to solve these problems, because the problems are not a lack of education or the wrong party won the White House or the House or whatever. The problems are internal to human beings. It's a part of our nature. It's a soul problem. And what we need is not a new program. We need a new heart. We need a new soul. We need a new life. We need to be saved. We need a Savior. We need to be fundamentally transformed. We don't need our country to be fundamentally transformed. We need our hearts to be fundamentally transformed as human beings. Now, I share all that because that's sort of the context of where Ruth is coming from. Because we followed along, we just finished flying through the book of Judges. And the book of Judges tells the story of how Israel, as the people of God, how they would get on track, they'd get off track, God would save them. They'd be on track, they'd get off track, God would save them. And time after time after time, this cycle would repeat itself. And you know, perhaps you can see some of that in your life as well. You look back over your life and you can say, hey, God brought me through that time in my life. Or maybe you're going through a tough time right now. And maybe what you need to be reminded of is one of two possibilities. Either one, look back to where God brought you through before and recognize that He's not going to let you down. Or two, maybe it's time for you to turn to God. Maybe you can't look back in your life and say, well, I can see where God brought me through because God's never brought you through because you never asked Him to. You've never turned to God. You know, you've never received Jesus. And so there's a couple of those possibilities out there. But here's the promise, the hope that's in the Word of God, and that is that if we turn to God and if we'll trust Him, things will work out. Maybe not in this life. Maybe not on earth. But in eternity, in the ultimate big picture of things that really matter. Now, before we get into Ruth, there's a few other things. There are three cultural context things you need to understand. The first one is how property was allotted in those days. They had this system in Old Testament Israel. It was, I don't know if this is even possible in this day and age. I'd imagine it's not. But what they did is they went into the Promised Land and they divided it up amongst the tribes. Now, you were a member of a tribe. And what that means is, you know, your ancestor, you know, you were whatever family, one of the 12 sons of Abraham, whatever. And so your family got a certain allotment of land, and that was yours forever. Now, as you know, maybe you don't know. Maybe you heard of somebody who's, oh, that guy owns, you know, 1,000 acres. He must be rich. No, it just means he has 1,000 acres. You know, you could be, have you ever heard the phrase, land rich and cash poor? You know, you can have land and not necessarily be wealthy. And so once you've got the land, well, what are you going to do with it? You can work the land. And so in the system that they had is you can go out and work the land, and anything you earned was yours. Now, any money, any goods, anything that you earned, anything that you acquired, anything that you built, You worked for it, you earned it, it's yours. The land was yours, all that was yours. But from time to time, people might find themselves in such desperate situations that they would actually sell their land. But you couldn't really sell the land. You could only sell it for a time. It was almost like a lease that had at maximum length of 70 years. And every 70 years, they had what was called the Year of Jubilee, and that land then went back to the original family that owned it. It's really an innovative, fascinating system that basically kept... You have you ever heard about how the rich keep getting richer and the poor get poorer and things like that? Well, the rich could only get so rich, and then we start all over again every 70 years. Bummer if you're born in the 50th year or whatever, because you're just... But anyway, nevertheless, so that's the way the land worked. So even though you might be poor, you always had a place to go. Second, they had a very innovative welfare system in those days. They had a very innovative welfare system that they had rules that regulated the harvest. For instance, the harvesters, when they went out into the field, the harvester could look left and could look right and move forward, but they couldn't go back. And then after them would come the next wave of workers, which would gather whatever was harvested up and tie it together, put it in sheaves and so on. And they had the same rule. They could look left, they could look right, but they couldn't go back. What this meant is that there was always stuff left in the fields. And so if you were poor, it was there for you to take. Nobody was going to bring it to you. You weren't going to get a check from the government. If you needed it, it was there, but you had to go work for it. So it was really, I wish there was a way we could do that. That was a pretty good system. Because think of it, not just a matter of, well, we need to make those people work, but it's a matter of human dignity. How many of you understand, when God created human beings, think about this, when God created the very first man, only man on earth, you know what he did? First thing he did with that man was give him a job, gave him responsibility. And I think the Bible implies this, that men especially, and humans in general, have a sense of dignity and self-worth by having responsibility, having a job, having something that they need to do. And so I don't think you do anybody any favors by just giving them stuff, but you give them the opportunity. And so that was a system that they had, but that's not what today's sermon is about. And then the other thing you need to understand is the way marriage worked in those days. In those days, men, I won't say they had all the rights. Women, especially in Israel, had it pretty good, all things considered. But the bottom line is men owned the property. Think about this. Back when God created marriage, remember what he said? For this reason, a woman shall leave her father and her mother and cling to her husband. The leaving and cleaving. But that's never said to the man. It's said to the woman. Because the man remains a part of the clan. He owns property. He's responsible. He's got that. Now, that's fine. Unless the man dies. Because then the woman has nothing. So what do? Kick her to the curb? Say good luck? No. They had this system, and here's the way it worked. Hey, if a woman's husband died, his brother had to marry her. So what if he was already married? Well, not marriage in the sense of like we think love and marriage and the cake and the carriage and all that kind of stuff. But as a sense of you then took responsibility for that woman and she came into your household. And so you were responsible for her well-being. And she became a part of your family. Now, if she had a husband who had achieved a lot and accomplished a lot and accumulated a lot and her husband died, hey, the brother who's first in line is like, yeah, come on in. Welcome to my family. You could really enrich yourself that way. If, on the other hand, though, she was poor and didn't have anything, you're taking a risk. You could actually lose. But that was the system. Now, I share all that so that you understand what's happening in Ruth. Take your Bible and open to Ruth, chapter 1. The story begins. I'll just give you the characters, and then we're going to skip down to verse 8 and read a little bit out of chapter 1. A guy named Elimelech is married to a woman named Naomi. There's a famine in the land. So times are tough in Israel. And so Elimelech and Naomi and his two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, you don't need to memorize these names. There's no quiz at the end of the service today. We'll save that for next week. But Elimelech, his wife Naomi, and their two sons head off to Moab, a foreign country. And they settle there, live their life. Mahlon and Chilion marry Moabite women, and then all the men die. there's a series of events that lead to this, and I'm not going to spoil the story for you. It's only four chapters long. You should go home and read it and get all the details. It's actually a very provocative story if you're familiar with all that goes on there. So I'll just leave that dangling out there for you. All the men die. And so then what happens is Naomi says to her daughters-in-law, hey, you know what? You guys have a life here. You have roots here. You've got family here. You stay here. I'm going to go back to Israel where I've got family. They'll be responsible for me. Don't worry about me. And that's then where we pick up the story. Chapter 1, verse 8. Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud and said to her, we will go back with you to your people. But Naomi said, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband, even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, twins. Would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me. At this, they wept again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. Now, understand this, by the way. Orpah didn't do anything wrong. She did exactly what Naomi was suggesting that she do. She was fully within her rights, so no wrong done here. But continue on. Look, said Naomi, Ruth's not leaving. Look, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. But Ruth replied, and this is the part that's often read in weddings, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. I love this next verse. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. All right, then the story goes on. So they end up back in Israel. Remember that welfare system I told you about? As soon as they get back to Israel, Naomi's old. Ruth says, don't worry about it. I'm going to work. I'll go out and pick up grain in the fields. I'll do it. Naomi says, hey, you know what? It's not really a safe place for a young single woman to be. So at least we've got this relative, this Boaz guy. Go to his field and tell him who you are. And he'll watch out for you. And so she ends up doing that. And go down in chapter 2 to verse 11. Boaz replied, I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law. So this is where they meet. Since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with the people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wing you have come to take refuge. Then skip down to verse 17. So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. I know you're thinking, an ephah. Yeah. What's that? It's a lot. But we'll come back to that a little bit later. All right, let me just tell you the rest of the story. You can go home and read Ruth. It's only four chapters long. Ruth goes back home to Naomi. Naomi says, so how was your day, dear? Yeah. And she tells her about all that happened and this guy Boaz. And Naomi says, you know, he's more than just a relative. He's our kinsman redeemer, which means he's one of those brothers of Elimelech, Naomi's dead husband. He's one of the guys in line that he could save us. He could save our bacon here. And so Naomi then gives Ruth some guidelines of what to do and how to basically go to him and propose marriage. Now, again, it's not like what we think of. It's not like the Jeremiah and Hannah kind of marriage. It's the formality of this levirate marriage of the, hey, you know, you're my kinsman redeemer and, you know, this is the way I'd like to see it go. She approaches Boaz, does what Naomi said. And Boaz says, this is sure great. I'd love to do this, but there's another guy in line ahead of me. And so in order to do this right, and we're going to talk more about Boaz next week, in order to do this right, we've got to go to him and give him first right of refusal, so to speak. And so they go to him. He says, nah, not interested. And they get married and live happily ever after. And then they have a grandson named David. You ever heard of David? You know, David and Goliath. David, greatest king of Israel, things like that. And then they have a great, 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 great grandson named Jesus. You see how this is working? You see, this is a classic story of the Old Testament. They experience famine. They go to a foreign land. It looks like they've lost everything. Their situation looks entirely hopeless. But you recognize now in retrospect that God's hand was in it all along. And Ruth is then presented to us as a hero. And so that's what I want to look at today is why is Ruth a hero? What makes her a hero? Three things. Number one, Ruth was determined. I love that verse. We read it in chapter 1 where Naomi said when she realized that she was determined, she just quit trying to get her to go away. She was determined. What does it mean to be determined? Let me put it to you this way. There's a difference between being determined and being stubborn. There's a difference between being determined and being pig-headed. That the person who is stubborn wants what they want. I want. The person who is determined has made a decision to pursue and wants what is right. Get the distinction? The stubborn person wants what they want. The determined person wants what's right. It's a whole different way of thinking about things. That's determination. Colossians 3, verse 2 in the New Testament says, set your mind on things above, not on earthly things. We are inundated in our culture, in our society, on earth. This is nothing new. It didn't take television to introduce us to this. It was way back in the Old Testament when they were, forbidden to covet, remember? Yeah. We've got to stop wanting the earthly things and start wanting the heavenly things. We've got to set our mind on the things above, the things that really matter, the things that ultimately will last. Is there anything wrong with earthly things? No. Again, you read the book. God created the earth for us to enjoy. The problem is when we, in Romans 1 talks about this, when we trade enjoyment for worship, we worship the earth. I don't mean literally. There's some people that do that too, but that's a different issue. But the earth and the things of the earth, it just becomes the center of our universe. It's like, no, that's not the way it's supposed to work. The earth is to be enjoyed. But we need to set our mind on the things that are above. We need to be like Ruth and make a determination to do what's right. Don't try to... I love the story. Ruth says, look, this would be better for you. Why don't you just stay here in Moab? The people know you. You have relatives. There's people there. This would be an easier life for you. How many of us, we determine God's will for our life based upon what's easier? You know what I mean? Oh, God, what do you want me to do? Oh, here's an opportunity. It must be God opening the door. Did you knock on that door? No, but it's open. I'll just walk through it, see what happens. Probably not a good idea to randomly walk through open doors, by the way. So Naomi says, hey, you know what? This would be... Here's an easy path for your life. But Ruth says, no. I'm going to do what's right. I'm going to accept your gods. I'm going to accept your people. I'm going to be willing to you. I'm going to do the right thing, no matter what, even though it's inconvenient, even though it's difficult. Second thing we read about Ruth is she was hardworking. This is where that ephah comes in. How much is an ephah? It's a lot. The fact that she gathered that much grain, threshed that much grain in one day, it's almost superhuman. It's a significant amount. Bottom line is, in chapter 2 indicates this, that as soon as they got back to Israel, she didn't say, man, I'm tired after a long journey. She said, all right, I'm going right to work. And not only did she go right to work, she went right to work and worked hard. There's nothing wrong with working hard. I don't know where we got off to thinking that God doesn't want us to work hard. God actually blesses hard work. That's what Proverbs 14:23 says. 2 Thessalonians 3 says something that, well, let me just quote it for you. Whoever won't work, don't let him eat. Okay. Kind of a different approach to things, isn't it? Well, you don't understand. No. It's pretty plain. And I'm not trying to make a political statement here. You can read into it whatever you want. But what I'm trying to do is encourage us to embrace the concept of hard work. There's nothing wrong with working hard. You know something I've learned over the years? I know a lot of people who never go on vacation. And it's not because they work too hard. It's because they don't work hard enough. The concept of getting away is meaningless to them. Get away from what? The couch? But there's, again, it's one of those paradoxes of life. The harder you work, the more you appreciate getting away. And it's a biblical concept. And Ruth was a hard worker. But more than anything else, I want you to see this about Ruth. Ruth was noble. Skip over to chapter 3. I didn't read this verse. After Ruth proposes this marriage arrangement with Boaz, this is the context of where Boaz says this to her. Verse 11, Ruth chapter 3. "And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of noble character." I mentioned last week that one of the, maybe the top phrase that irritates me the most is when people say, "Just follow your heart." For those of you who need the reminder, Jeffrey Dahmer just followed his heart and ate people. Okay, don't just follow your heart. Do what's right. Okay, there's a huge difference sometimes. But there's a close second when it comes to phrases that really irritate me, that out of the mouths of Christians. When non-Christians talk like this, have at it. This is why we're here. Just follow your heart, and I don't care what people think about me. Really? First of all, you're probably lying. But second of all, you know, you should. You really should. I mean, now some people are just envious, petty, jealous haters. You can't worry about those people. In fact, those people, the fact that they say things about you, they're telling you more about themselves than they are about you. And you probably know that. But if people think that you're a lazy, no good for nothing, blanky blank bum or whatever, at least pause long enough to ask yourself, gosh, why would anybody think that? Because if they have a reason, if people have a reason for thinking that you're a bad person, you might have to embrace the possibility that maybe you're a bad person. Or at least not quite perfect. And maybe we all have some character flaws, personality issues that we could go ahead and give a little attention to. Instead of just saying, well, I don't care what people think about me. You know, 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 7. 1 Timothy 3 talks about qualifications for church leadership. And by the way, it's not just church leaders. These are the character traits that every Christian is supposed to pursue. And the people who best epitomize them should be your leaders. But one of the things it says in 1 Timothy 3:7 is that the elder, the church leader, must have a good reputation with outsiders. I remember when I first started pastoring in Arizona. I'm meeting people in the community and trying to invite them to church. And I met one person in particular, and she said, "Oh, you're with that church. My neighbor is on your board." And then she said, "I would never go to a church that he attends." And then as she started to explain to me why, and I realized what just a horrible human being and crummy neighbor he was, I'm like, okay, we might have an issue here. But that just leads to a whole other set of stories that I'll save for another sermon. But the bottom line is, it does matter what other people think of us. Not that we should, you know, base our life on what other people think of us, but we need to focus on developing noble character. You know, who we are does matter. Think about this. Jesus' plan for reaching the world was not just winning an election. In fact, I'm pretty sure that wasn't even part of it. It wasn't about, you know, getting the right people in office or having the right curriculum in the school system or any of those kind of things. It was you and me being salt and light, living lives of Christian character, transforming lives one at a time, multiplied by the number of people in the church, developing a life of character. Now, understand this. Noble character, to be a person of noble character like Ruth, takes a lifetime to develop. You're never there. You're always getting there. But noble character, while it takes a lifetime to develop, it makes a lifelong impact. You want to really make a difference in the world? Develop godly, noble character in your life. Be an honest follower of Jesus. Doesn't mean you're not going to make mistakes. We all sin. We all fall short. The Bible's pretty clear on that. But what are we trying to do? See, here's the deal. The world says, be who you are. What does that even mean? Be who you are? be who you want to be? What does that mean? But see, the Bible is in direct contrast to that. God doesn't say, be who you are. God says, I want you to be more than you imagine. More than you think you are. More than you think you can be. So, well, how can I be more than I am? This is where God comes in. You see, we need God to transform our core, our soul, our character, our very nature. But being more, like Ruth, begins with a determination. You've got to make a decision. Am I just going to be whatever I am? Or am I going to be more? Am I going to be more? That's my challenge for you today. You've got to make a decision. You've got to make a commitment, like Ruth did, to be more. Be a follower of Jesus. What does that mean? Do you understand that fundamentally what's wrong in the world is not that the wrong party is in charge of the White House or the Congress or anything like that? It's not because of the dictators and despots around the world. It's because of sin in the human heart. It's a nature problem. And I don't mean animals and animal planet. I mean inside the core of our very being. It's something that we don't have the ability or the power to change. We might have the desire to change, but what we need is a Savior. We need somebody. We need something that can fundamentally change who we are. We don't need to fundamentally transform our country. We need to fundamentally transform the core of who we are as individuals. And only Jesus can do that. When we recognize that Jesus died for our sin, He rose from the dead, He can do that. If we will yield our life to Him and say, I'll be a follower of Jesus. Our options are either to be whatever or to be more. Let's stand together and we'll pray. Thank you, Lord. You brought us here today to hear from you. I really believe that, Lord. And I pray that we've all heard from you, either from your word, from somebody else, from the songs, or directly from your spirit, Lord, speak into our hearts and into our soul. Lord, if there's anybody here who has never made a decision to be a follower of Jesus, I pray that today, they might be thinking in their mind, yeah, I'm all for that. Sounds like a good thing. I've just never really made that decision. Lord, let today be the day that they step over that line. And Father, for the rest of us, we invite you to invade our soul with your presence, to transform us into more than who we are.